That's very nice. So I was asking where everybody is from, so just to get a sense. So there are Canadians here.
Yeah.
Okay. There are people from Greece. One. Okay. Where else?
Brazil.
Okay. I'm going to Brazil next month. India.
Poland.
Okay. China. Cool. Where?
Croatia.
Okay, I've been there. I was in Pula. Pula?
Oh.
I didn't pronounce it right.
Pula.
Yeah, I was there during the war. That's another story. With some crazy Italian friends. Chile.
Italy?
Yeah, okay. Somewhere else I've lived.
Latvia?
Good. Any Americans? No. You used to live there. I used to live there too. Okay. Okay, cool. So what I thought I would do is talk about the nature of space and time, which is the basic subject in physics. But before I do that, what I could do, if there's interest, is tell a story, because some of you are here, presumably you're here because you're interested in physics or math or science. And I could tell, if you're interested, the story of how, okay, leave it open. I hate this, I feel claustrophobic when the doors are all closed. There's no windows in here. I could tell the story of how I got from when I was your age to being here, to making my living as a scientist. If that would be interesting. Okay, good. And since there are people here from many countries, if I speak too fast or too colloquially, please interrupt and stop and slow me down. Okay? Because I know what it's like to be at a party where everybody's speaking Italian or Portuguese or something. And I know that, I'm sure your English is much better than any of my other languages, but I know how hard it is. So please stop me or slow me down if you want. Don't be shy. And also, I'm very informal as a lecturer, so feel free to interrupt, to ask me questions, to divert me any way you want to. Okay. So when I was a teenager in high school, I was not interested in physics at all. I was interested in literature. My mother is a playwright. I was interested in rock and roll, which I was doing. I had a band. I was interested in politics because it was a very political time in my country, in the United States. And I was pretty rebellious. Now, as a result, my grades were not very good. And there came a time, and I don't know if there comes in your different educational systems, but there came a time when the school made a decision about whether you could study at an advanced level, which would lead to going to college or not at an advanced level. So I was told that I could study at an advanced level in either literature or mathematics, but not both, and not any other subjects. No science subjects, no physics, chemistry, biology, no history, etc. So I had a choice of just English and math. And I was interested in English, but I was also angry about that, because I thought that I could do English and math, and as well as all the other things. So my parents had a friend who was a mathematician, who was a teacher at a small college in the neighborhood. And he had played a role in my life already, because when I was 10 years old, he had let me play on a computer, which was a big deal in those days. I know these days it's not a big deal, and I see somebody there has a computer in the back, but probably many of you have computers at home, But in those days, computers were fairly new, and the idea that a kid could play on a computer was completely radical. And also these days, a computer much less powerful than that Mac sitting there took up two rooms this size, plus all the air conditioning equipment and everything. And there was no interface to play with it. What you had to do was write a program in Fortran, which you had to type into punch cards. Maybe you remember this. Which you had to type into punch cards, and then you took the punch cards to the computer center where the computer was, and you gave them to somebody who read them into the computer, and then it printed out a list of errors in your program, and then you had to come back, go away, correct your program, okay, come back 3 days later, punch new punch cards, and so forth. But I spent the summer when I was 10 years old doing that, which again, any kid could do now, but in those days it was a big deal, and I was kind of an experiment. So anyway, so this guy knew me, and I went to him, and I said, look, I'm unhappy about this. Of course, I put it in much more angry, vulgar terms. My school doesn't think that I can do math. So he said, I'll make you a deal. Why don't you come over the summer and take college mathematics? Take basically pre-calculus and the beginning of calculus this summer. I was 14. At our college, and if you do well the next year, you can take calculus. And so you can skip all the high school stuff. Okay, so I did that. And the result was that I discovered two things. One of them was that I could learn math easily, quickly. The other one was that I wasn't actually that good at it. And that may seem like a kind of contradiction, but it's really not, because what mathematicians, there are different ways of thinking. And what I realized is that I could think very intuitively, very quickly, and I could understand something and visualize it. But the side of mathematics where you had to make a proof, and you had to reason carefully through a series of steps and make a proof, I was not very good at it all. And everybody else in my classes was much better than me at that. Of course, everybody else in my classes was 6 years older than me, but I didn't take that into account. Maybe only 5 years old, but anyway. So I learned math, and I kept going to college courses at night, which also contributed to my learning math badly, because I went to night school, to night college. But that's what I was doing when I was in high school, and with, you know, I spent most of the time on rock and roll bands, and, you know, we were trying to get gigs and so forth. Is this interesting? Or is this just a personal story? Okay. So then I met Buckminster Fuller. And I don't know, does anybody here know who Buckminster Fuller was? Sort of. Who was he? There's a molecule, yes. The buckyball is named after him. Okay. So Buckminster Fuller was an inventor and a mathematician and a writer. He's sort of the world's worst poet, he was, and five or six other things. He had dropped out of college, his first year of college, and become an inventor. And he had invented many, many, many things. For example, the geodesic dome, the idea of taking a sphere and defining the surface of a sphere with triangles and making a structure with triangles, which now is very common. They're called geodesic domes. He was one of the first environmentalists. His philosophy was that the world could become much richer and one could feed, you know, and contribute to the development of the poor countries, to feeding people, to having a much higher standard of living by using technology to use resources much more efficiently. So he designed cars that got 100 miles to the gallon. This was in the 1940s and 1950s. He designed houses that were energy self-sufficient. that were, in terms of water and waste and so forth, were self-sufficient. He was way, way, way ahead of his time. And he was at that point in his 70s. And my father, who had wanted to be an architect, was a fan of his. And one day, my father read in the newspaper that Buckminster Fuller was in town and was giving a talk at some conference. And he said to me, why don't you invite him to speak at your high school? And at that time, I and a friend of mine, Lizzie Curtis, not that it matters, but anyway, we were dating at that point, were heads of this forum program to invite people to speak at the high school. So I called up the hotel where he was staying, it said in the newspaper where he was staying, and left a message that he was invited to speak at Walnut Hills High School. And then I went to school, and in English class, in third period, I got called to the principal's office, which was not a good thing. And the principal was there on the telephone, holding his hand on the telephone, and he said, there's somebody on the phone who said his name is Fuller, and you're supposed to pick him up at 1:30 because he's giving a talk here. And how come I don't know that? And so I said, look, this is really great, say yes. And he said, he's not some kind of political radical like the last guy. I said, no, it's fine, it's fine. He is radical, but he's not political. And I convinced the principal to say yes. And Lizzie had a car, and we went downtown, and we picked him up, and he was standing there at the corner. And we brought him up to the school. The principal thereby, meanwhile, had looked him up and had realized he was a big deal, so he called an assembly of the whole school. And so the whole school was there. Buckminster Fuller was introduced. He came out. He took a chair from backstage, put it front stage center, took the microphone from the platform, put it in his breast pocket, sat down, took out his hearing aids, closed his eyes, and talked for 6 hours. And, when he was done, there were only about 12 or 15 of us there. But I was completely enthralled, and I wanted to be an architect and an inventor. So then I started playing with all kinds of structures, and because I knew a lot of math, I could learn the math that I needed to take curved surfaces and divide them up into triangles, into basically, rather than having, I'm very bad at drawing, but rather than having, some curved surface, you define it by triangles. It's called a triangularization. And then you build that. I also tried to go into business and build houses and swimming pool covers and, things like that. But luckily, nobody actually bought any of the things that I was offering. Because I had no idea how to actually build them. But I knew how to, use the math I knew and write a little computer program and find out how long all these things should be and who should be connected to who and everything. Okay. So then I dropped out of high school because I was bored. And that was in my last year of high school. And I was going to be an architect, an inventor, and build these things and so forth. So I had lots of plans. And then I started getting into, the microphone's still working. I started getting into more and more complicated curved surfaces, stretching spheres, all sorts of complicated shapes. And I started to try to learn the math that I could to divide very complicated surfaces into triangles and write little computer programs to use that math. And I didn't quite have enough math, so I went to the public library since I wasn't going to school. I went to the public library, and I got a book of the math that I found out that I needed, which was called Differential Geometry, or Tensor Calculus. It was an advanced form of calculus for dealing with curved surfaces. And I discovered that in the book that I got that I read, there was a chapter at the end about Einstein's theory of general relativity, which describes space and time as being curved, like these surfaces, but higher dimensional. 3 + 1 dimensions, 4 dimensions of all being curved. And this turned out that the math that I was looking for to make my designs was the same math that Einstein had used in 1915, 1916 to invent his theory of general relativity. So there was that chapter on general relativity which described the basic ideas, and I was fascinated. And I went back to the library, I got a book on general relativity, and I started to read it, and I was really interested. Then I got a book about Einstein. Of course, my parents had told me about Einstein. I had heard something about him. But I decided I wanted to know who this guy was. So there was a book of essays about him, and it had an essay by him, which was autobiographical. It was written when he was about 70. I was then 16. And in the book, he describes being an adolescent and why he became a scientist. So he describes feeling very fed up. He was very against society. He was from Germany, and at that time, German society was very militaristic. This was around the turn of the previous century. And he describes being very angry, being fed up. His parents had a lot of failures in business. He doesn't quite say that, but now I know what happened. His parents had a lot of failures in their attempts to make money and have businesses. And Einstein had dropped out of school and had actually given up German citizenship and moved. His parents had moved to Italy, and he had taken a winter in which he took a copy of a book by Maxwell, who invented the theories of electrodynamics, and hiked across the Alps, staying in different places and studying this book of Maxwell's electrodynamics. This is when he was 16, 17. And eventually he made his way to Switzerland, where he enrolled in a kind of preparatory school to get him prepared to pass examinations so he could go to university. And he describes the sense that human life is very ugly, it's very short, it's a struggle. He says by the existence of a stomach, everybody is fated to have to struggle to earn a living. And one wants to escape from this and transcend this existence. And the way to do it is to make contact with truth and with beauty. And out there in nature, there are these beautiful laws which govern everything, which govern motion, which govern light, which govern matter. And you can transcend your human existence by learning these laws and by trying to understand them and rise to a level of beauty and truth which enriches your life. And he describes this experience of finding solace, of finding a lot of happiness, contemplating the truths of nature. And you can read that too. It's an essay called Albert Einstein. It's called Autobiographical Notes, and the book is called Albert Einstein, Philosopher of Scientists. So I read that essay one night somebody had stood me up. I was supposed to meet a girl and we were supposed to go somewhere, and she had stood me up and I read this. And it appealed to me, and I decided right there, more or less instantly, and I think because of this, I've been very fortunate, but I decided instantly on reading this that that's what I was going to do. And I had no doubt. I thought, well, I'm not a good mathematician. I told you I knew I wasn't a good mathematician. But you don't have to be a good mathematician to do this stuff. You just have to know how to use the math. And so I got the sense that I could do what Einstein was talking about. So I just decided I'm going to do this. And not only that, but he goes on in the essay to describe what issues were left unfulfilled, on what things that he still wanted to understand. He was writing in 1950, so after having invented quantum theory, which he started, and invented special relativity, invented general relativity, and started the scientific field of cosmology and many other things, he was very unsatisfied about the state of science in 1950. And he was unsatisfied because principally of two things. One of them is that he didn't believe quantum mechanics. I know you've been learning quantum mechanics. And quantum mechanics, he understood, works very well to describe nature, but he didn't believe it. He didn't believe it was the real thing. He didn't believe it was the truth about nature. He thought it was just some bookkeeping device, some math you could use with some mystical words associated with it which hid the truth, and he wanted to find what was really behind it. One way to say it is that quantum mechanics is always statistical. You're always making predictions about probabilities and statistics. Doesn't tell you what goes on in a given instance of an experiment. Doesn't tell you where a particle is and why it's there. Just tells you the probabilities to find at different places. So Einstein wanted to find the real truth behind quantum mechanics. And the other thing he wanted to do was connect that search with the theory of space and time. Because his idea was that general relativity was just the starting point of a new and deep understanding of space and time, and it was just the start. And it had much further to go, and part of where it had to go was unifying with matter, and part of where it had to go was understanding quantum mechanics. So I read all that evening, and I decided, okay, I can probably do this, and I'll work on those problems. I'll take those as a starting point. And so that's what I decided to do. And I've been very fortunate because, for some bizarre reason, I guess okay. I mean, I don't know if I would have been, you know, if I would have stayed in rock and roll, you know, if I would have been, you know, the guitarist in U2, where I would be still playing, you know, weddings and parties. probably the second. And now that since then I've met some real, you know, some people who really did succeed at rock and roll, and I recognize that they have a level of talent that I didn't have, let alone jazz and, you know, so forth. So I've managed to make a living at this, and it's been, it's been wonderful so far. The only thing from my perception of that moment that's really changed is that I actually like being a human being much more than Einstein did, or than he expressed. So actually, I don't feel that life is ugly and short and mean and all those things Einstein felt. I feel like I'm having quite a good time, and many of the people I know are having all right. So I don't have this, I don't feel anymore this need to transcend human life. But I still very much love doing science and doing this kind of science. So that's the basic story. Then I had to solve certain problems, like I was a high school dropout, and I had to figure out how to get an education. And some people who were very smart convinced me that I should go to college, which took some convincing. Because I was very screwed up, and I had this idea I could teach myself everything, which isn't true, by the way, if you have that idea. You can teach yourself certain things, but you can't teach yourself physics. It's very, very interesting. There are math prodigies who just take off from teenagers and they just soar. There are music prodigies who, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 are soaring. You can be a prodigy in music, in math, you can be a prodigy in art. You can't be a prodigy in physics. At least I've known people who have tried, and they never go anywhere. I mean, the people who were, you know, like got their PhD at 14 or 16, who I know, were burnt out by the time they were 25. You can't do it that way. And the reason you can't do it is that physics is a craft. It's not just about being really smart. In fact, it's not even clear you have to be really smart. But what you have to be is determined. You have to be courageous. You have to be confident. And you have to get trained. It's a craft. It's like being a boat builder or a sculptor or something like that. You have to learn your craft. And the only way to learn your craft is by studying and working with people. All those things that you may hate, the problems, the problem sets, and so forth, are about learning your craft. And the other thing that it's about is you have to think well. And thinking is really, really hard. And it's not clear that being smart helps you think better. It's really not, because if you're really smart, you jump to conclusions. And often you miss the whole point. And people who, some of the best physicists I know, some of the people who I listen to most, who I pay attention to, are not the people who seem to be the smartest, the people who make a lot of mistakes, who get confused easily, but somehow manage to think through things and discover things that other people miss. And Einstein himself was somebody like that. I had the honor, much later on, of meeting some people who knew Einstein, most of whom are dead now, unfortunately. And they all remarked about how dumb he seemed. You know, how slow compared to other people, how slow he thought, how easily it was for him to get confused.
Okay.
So that's the story. And
with that introduction, maybe I'll tell you something about what Einstein did,
and start really with the most basic questions, because what physics is about is the basic questions. So the most basic question of all, can somebody try?
Why are we here?
Why are we here? Physics is very bad at answering that, but I will write it down. I assume that you. Why are we
not in this room?
Not in this room. To this pretentious guy who thinks that he has an interesting story to tell. Physics is very bad at answering that. If you want, at the end, you can bring it back, and I can speculate what we know from physics about that. But when physicists start speculating about that, run. Okay. Somebody else, yeah?
What are we made of?
Okay.
What's everything made of?
Okay, what else? Yeah.
How does everything work?
How?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes?
Why things are the way they are?
I love this use of the word things, but that's right. Why things are...
I just want it to be as general as possible.
No. Einstein had a way of putting this question, which you might find interesting. He said that what he was most interested in was whether God had any choice in how the world was created or not. And not that it's very controversial whether Einstein believed in God. He certainly didn't believe in a personal God, but he believed in some great spirit that he used to talk about, the old one or God, and he wondered whether there was any choice. Is there more than one? A modern way to say that would be, if you know what the laws of nature are, okay, if we teach you what we think the laws of nature are, is there choice? Could the laws of nature have been different? For example, could there be not one electron, but two particles which were like electrons? Or if you know the elementary particles of the electrons and the protons and the neutrons, protons and neutrons are very close in mass. The electron is 1,800 times lighter. It's 1/1,800th, roughly, of the proton mass. Okay? But the neutron is only 3 electron masses heavier than the proton. So part of your question is, why is the electron so light? Why are the proton and neutron almost the same mass? Why is the neutron a little heavier? That kind of thing, right? Okay. I can come back to that. Yeah?
What is time?
Okay. What is time? Okay. Somebody come up here. I'm just yeah.
Does God play nice?
Good. This was Einstein's way of saying that he didn't believe in quantum mechanics because he didn't believe probabilities were fundamental. Okay. One or two more.
What's physics?
What is physics? What do you mean by that? Okay. My teacher in college used to say, physics is the study of everything. And then I would say, but what about why are we here? And he would say, well, not quite everything. Yeah.
How was space created?
How was space created? Okay. Okay, let me ask you about that question. How was space created? So what makes you think space was created?
I didn't say that. I don't know. That's why I'm asking.
Okay. Can we start with, so let me ask you, what is space?
Three-dimensional reality.
Okay. Why three?
There's no foundation for it. That's why I'm confused.
Okay, good. That's part of her question. Sorry, I don't know anybody's name. You know, why is the space two-dimensional or five-dimensional or nine-dimensional? That's part of the question of why are things the way they are? Why are there only three dimensions of space and not 942?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to just add here, this is my question. What is space? Okay. I want to stop there unless there's, I'll take one more.
What is the theory that discusses everything?
Okay, you want the theory of everything. Yeah, that's what many people who do this for a living want, of everybody. Okay. Now, I'll stop it there for a minute. Okay, these are many of the fundamental questions. How about I tell you a little bit about this one and these, and if you like at the end we can come back to this. Okay. I'm thinking these days myself a lot about time. And actually, for those people who are Brazilian here, very often science is best done in collaboration, or at least having people to talk to. And I have a very interesting Brazilian friend, Roberto Mangibera Unger, who is somebody that you might have heard of in a different context, who we're thinking about now.
Yeah.
Okay. He's in politics in Brazil.
What's the name?
Unger. Ask your parents. Okay. Anyway, he's a philosopher who's involved in politics, and he called me from Brasilia, and we talk about what is time. And actually, very interestingly, in Brasilia, he's the minister of the future. So I'm looking for a blackboard here. Okay. So let's start with time. So somebody raised the question, somebody else answered. What is time? A fourth dimension, okay. How have you studied physics, like old-fashioned Newtonian dead physics? Yes?
It's a measurement of change.
A measurement of change, okay. So, okay, so. Okay, and I'm going to write this fourth dimension thing here, and I'm going to come back to that. What's interesting about this is that that makes time a lot like space, and that's interesting because the following thing happens way, way back at the beginning of physics. which is that people, you know, watch something move. Right? So you watch the chalk. And way, way back in the early 17th century, Galileo and Descartes realized you could do this. You could graph height and time, and then you could draw a curve. Okay, and this tells you the height as a function of time. Okay? And you've done something there very mysterious, which is that you've made time into a dimension of space. Because this is actually not time, this is actually just a distance along the blackboard. So you've made a metaphor, an analogy, between the passage of time and the dimension of space. And the future of science from then on was based on being able to do that trick. But because then you can ask, what function is this? This is some height as a function of time. And you can make measurements. Okay, you can measure time. By the way, does anybody know how Galileo was able to measure? Because that goes really fast, right? Less than a second, it's up and down.
He was in power position, and he could feel the changes in the rhythm, like 1.74, I guess.
Very good. That's right. Where did you learn that?
I read Gamma Particle.
Yeah, that's very good. Galileo's father was a famous musician and music theorist and composer, and Galileo himself was a talented musician, and he could divide time into a 16th of a pulse beat, which if you're a musician, you think about a pulse beat and then dividing that into 16ths. Okay? Okay, so that's how Galileo was able to do that, because there were no clocks in those days. There were no mechanical clocks. Mechanical clocks that were reliable came later with Huygens, which was half a century later in Holland. So, does anybody know just what function this is? What the name of this curve is?
Parabola.
It happens to be a parabola, and that was one of the discoveries that Galileo made. Okay. Now, that makes time into a dimension like space, and that gives you the fantasy that if the world just had one dimension, that actually there's a two-dimensional world, and you could graph everything that's happening in this two-dimensional world, not just the ball, but all the paths of all the particles, and the world would be laid out in four dimensions. There would be no change. There would just be a frozen reality. No change at all. And there are some people who believe that. I don't. But there are some people who believe that. That has a name that's called the Bloch universe. And it's the idea that time is not fundamental. Time is really just like a dimension of space. And there are people who believe that. Now, I want to get back to this definition of change. And whose was that? I forget. Okay, so I'm going to, can I query you on this? If you don't want to answer, that's okay. What if there's no change?
Then we wouldn't be thinking or moving.
Yeah, supposing that there was a system, okay, and there was no change in the system, would there be time? Okay, supposing in the whole universe there was no change, would there be time? Yes. Somebody says yes?
Time is a reference for the measurement of change.
Okay, so you say yes, and...
I don't think so, as of yet.
Okay, okay, no. So, okay, if no change, is there time? Okay, and this is the kind of question that physics answers, yes, or addresses.
Maybe there is time that they wouldn't think that there was time, like they wouldn't be aware that there was time in the past, but
because there was no change. But maybe there still would be time.
There's still time.
Okay, so we have a couple of votes for yes and some votes for no. Should we actually take a vote?
Yes.
Okay, how many people say no? Does somebody want, do you want to count?
It's kind of like a tree falling in the woods and nobody's around.
Yeah.
I get 22.
Okay, and yes? Okay. So democracy is a way to reach the truth about certain things, but not necessarily about space and time. Okay. Let me tell you the history of this question. Okay. This is a very key question for the history of physics, for the history of mathematics, for the history of philosophy. This is one of the key ancient questions. Okay. Newton says yes. Newton's book, so I don't know if you know, the physics that you learned in high school, you know, about laws of motion, the three laws of motion, equal and opposite reaction, forces, mass, times, all that stuff is Newton. And all that stuff was in a book that Newton wrote in 1687. And Newton, in the introduction to that book, and I would, and if you're interested in science, I would recommend something that you don't usually do in high school or even in college in science classes, which is read the history. Go to the library and get that book. It's called Principia Mathematica. It's translated into most languages, and read the introduction. And in the introduction, Newton starts by addressing this question. And he says, yes, he says, time, absolute, and mathematical, exists and flows independent of anything else, whether anything is happening or not. If there was nothing in the universe, so there was no change, there would still be time. And he says very clearly that when you write things like h is a function of t, that t refers to this absolute mathematical time, which is always there and always flowing, can't be affected by anything. It flows at a constant rate. You can't speed it up, you can't slow it down, you can't affect it. Everything changes according to it. It cannot be changed by anything. Okay? In fact, he identified this time. Newton was a very religious person. I don't know if you know that. He spent in his life much more time on theology than he did on physics, and even more time on alchemy and mysticism than he did on either of those things. In fact, he probably only spent 4 years or so of his whole life on physics and mathematics, in which, you know, he invented calculus, invented, you know, what you know as physics and everything. So this was Newton's answer. And that answer is built into the structure of Newtonian physics. The T, when you write, you know, velocity is the change in position by time, by change in time, and equations like that, you are using Newton's way of thinking about time. So Newton is with the slight majority of yours, of you. Okay? Descartes said no. Huygens said no. Galileo was not very clear. Leibniz, I don't know if any of you know the name of Leibniz.
Yes.
Yes. Leibniz, what do you know Leibniz for?
He invented calculus.
He invented calculus as well as notation. He invented the notation. He was a diplomat. He was also a philosopher. He invented symbolic logic. He matrices. He anticipated the notion of the computer. There are some people who have called, some philosophers, historians of philosophy, have said he was the smartest person who ever lived. Also, unlike Newton, who was a very, actually, we don't really know much about Newton's life. He was very secretive and very, none of the books about him draw a portrait of a character that makes any sense. But Leibniz was a very friendly, engaging person. He was a diplomat. He had lots of friendships and correspondence. And he said very strongly, no. He said, very much like what you said, he said, time is change. He said, more particularly, okay, time is change in relationships. Because he thought that everything that existed was defined by relationships between things. Nothing was defined absolutely. Everything was defined in terms of relationships. Also space. I'll come to space in a few minutes. And time was change in relationships and nothing else. So Leibniz said, no. They had a great debate, which they carried out through letters. It's not clear if they ever met. There's speculation. They might have met when Leibniz made some secret trips to England because he was a representative of the German family that eventually became the kings and queens of England as they were negotiating to take over England. So they might have met, but it's not recorded. But they corresponded directly, mostly indirectly, through, for example, there was a princess, Sophia, who was a student of Leibniz, who was a great fan of his and a great friend, and she made contact with Newton, and she precipitated a correspondence where they debated about these things. They didn't resolve it. They didn't resolve it at all. Now, Newton, in some sense, won the debate because his version of physics, which his answer to the question about time, became physics that people taught and people used from then, which was 1687, until the beginning of the 20th century when Einstein overthrew Newton's physics. And interestingly enough, Einstein was very strongly here. And his theory of general relativity, which definitively overthrew Newton's conception of space and time, was very much based on the answer no, that time and also space are just relationships. There's nothing, so if you go back a minute to what is space, there's the same question, okay, is space absolute? And a way to ask that question is that, supposing we took the whole universe, okay, and we moved it 10 meters to the left, okay, but we're keeping everything in relative position, okay, we just move everything all together 10 meters to the left, okay, would that be different? And then we consider the two universes, the one before and one after we move it 10 meters to the left. Okay. Are they different universes or the same universe? Well, that's the question. That's the question. Okay. And Leibniz argued that they were the same because any relative distance is the same between any two things. The distance between these two pieces of chalk doesn't change. Okay. All the forces only depend on the distances between things. So the world will evolve the same as before. Okay? And you couldn't possibly tell, being in the world, whether you were in the first world or the world that was 10 meters to the left. And therefore, there was no difference. They were identical. Not just similar, but precisely the same. And Newton And this is in the correspondence that Princess Sophia had going back and forth. Newton said, no, God can tell. Because space is how God perceives reality. It was Newton called space the sensorium of God. It's God's sense organ. It's how God can perceive everything. And we can't tell that the universe is 10 meters over there from where it was. But God could tell. Because God sees absolute space. Not relationships between things, but absolute space. And Leibniz said, that's absurd, because if that were true, then God could bring about something for which he could not justify. Leibniz had a principle that anything about the way the world was, this comes back to your question of why are things the way they are, every question about why things are the way they are had to have a rational explanation. And Leibniz's conception of God was that it would be beneath the dignity of God to have a choice about something that there was no rational explanation for. You could not possibly explain why the universe was here rather than 10 meters to the left. It makes no difference, so there couldn't be an explanation for why it was 10 meters to the left and not there. And therefore, it can't make any sense to ask the question. Therefore, the notion of space must be such that it's absurd to ask the question of moving the whole universe. Space must only be something that's defined within the universe as a result of relationships between things in the universe. And they argued on religious and theological grounds about this over and over again. Because it had to do with, there were religious implications, there were philosophical implications to these questions. Okay. If you're interested in this story, by the way, the best version of the story I know is a novel by Neal Stephenson. Does anybody know him? I don't know how to spell his name, Stephenson. But he has a 3,000-page novel which is about the argument between Newton and Leibniz. Although you have to read 2,500 of those pages to realize that that's what the novel is about. But he gives a portrayal of the argument and why it was important to people at those times, as well as the only realistic portrayal of these people's characters that I've ever read. Okay. Now, Einstein's theory of general relativity is for both space and time strongly in this column. And the consequences of that are that there is no such thing. You could ask, okay, part of this question, why are things the way they are, is for Newton. So Newton said about space that it's three-dimensional, it's Euclidean geometry, it's infinite, it goes on and on forever. Okay. Euclidean geometry is what you learned in school, okay, that the angles of triangles add up to 180 degrees, parallel lines never meet, etc. Okay? Why? That was a question. And it was also a question, how is it that a human being could have perceived eternal truths like that? Because if the space was always the same, always three-dimensional, always Euclidean geometry, how could human beings, by experiment, by deduction, by argument, have gotten from the kinds of things that we can get our hands on, which is what we observe, to eternal truths like that? Okay? And there was a philosopher called Immanuel Kant who tried to answer that question and gave, in a long, complicated book that I studied in college, an answer for how Newton was able to arrive at eternal and correct truth about the nature of space. Okay. Well, it turns out that it wasn't true. Okay. The answer is it wasn't true. Kant answered a false question. Not that he wasn't a good philosopher, but he answered a false question, what you find in Einstein, okay, is that space is three-dimensional, as far as we know, but it could have other dimensions. It's, the mathematics easily allows there to be other dimensions. And the geometry is anything. I mean, there's a class of it, but the geometry of space can curve, just like those surfaces that I was studying in high school. The geometry of three-dimensional space can curve arbitrarily, so parallel lines can meet. The angles of triangles can add up to anything. Okay. And not only that, it's different in different places of space, so it changes in space. So the geometry is different here than every other place in the sun. It responds, it changes in time. So waves, so for example, there can be, just like there can be water waves, there are waves in the geometry of space which pass through and ripple the geometry of space and change the angles of triangles. And as when a gravitational wave goes through, the angles of triangles can get bigger than 180 degrees and less, and they can oscillate. And it responds to matter. And I think so the geometry is different near heavy bodies than away from heavy bodies. I think you're going to study some of this. So I just want to emphasize the key points. Okay? And it's only about relationships. So there's no absolute description of the geometry from which it makes sense to move the whole thing 10 feet or 10 meters to the left. It comes down very much on this side. Okay. Now, since more than half of you voted against this prospect, that you should be asking me a question now. So somebody, you should be challenging me. I mean, I'm just some guy who, you know, who's standing up and telling you this. What, somebody, I mean, challenge me. Well, where do I stand? I'll put that aside. Ask me that again as we get to the end. Nobody wants to ask me why I believe this? Yeah?
What defines a system in which there's absolutely no change? Because you can still perceive, and I guess for us, what makes us perceive time in which we can sense that, like, time in a Newton kind of scale is going by? Like.
Yeah, so very good. Very good. So we experience time. We experience in our own experience, our own consciousness, change and time. Okay. And how is that connected to the T in physics? It is a question that you raise. It's, well, you could, the part of it, okay? And that's a very good question. That's a very, very good question, and I'm not going to try to answer it. But because it is a very good question. Okay, what I thought somebody was going to stand up and say, well, how do you know? I mean, how do you know that, so Newton gave a theory, it was based on a certain, and this is the kind of stuff they don't tell you in high school or college, okay? The point of Newton's physics, okay, is not just that it works and it gets the right answers and you can build bridges with it and build buildings that don't fall down. The point of Newton's physics is that it realized a philosophical idea. That's why Newton invented it. Newton didn't care about buildings standing up and bridges not falling down. Newton was interested in the nature of reality. And he had a philosophical idea that he believed in passionately, in his case, not in all cases, but in his case because it came from a theological conviction. To spell it out, if you don't know the history, Newton was a Unitarian at a time when it was illegal to be a Unitarian. That is, he did not believe in the Holy Trinity. He was a Christian who did not believe in the Trinity. And you could be killed for that in the England of his day. Okay. And you could, by the way, you should not be a fellow of Trinity College, which he was, which required taking an oath, which mysteriously Newton never took. He was never required to take the oath. Okay, even though he was, for his whole life, a fellow at Trinity College. Okay, so these were very serious matters. And Newton traced his theological beliefs to philosophical disagreements. And the existence of absolute time and absolute space were essential to what he passionately believed. Now, it doesn't matter from the point of view of the history of science whether it was theology or rock and roll or politics or whatever it was that was behind his belief, but the point was that Newton was primarily interested in philosophical questions and what were these kind of questions and what was the nature of the world, and he had a passionately held view which he translated into mathematics and physics and then presented to the world, and then it worked. Now, Einstein had different philosophical views. He lived in a different time. He was not religious. In fact, he rebelled from religion. He rebelled politically in his day. He was a pacifist, etc. Okay. And behind his passionately held views about the nature of reality, okay, were some things that were essential for him. And they led him to take these answers. Okay. Why, if we analyze it, it's because he believed that what was primary was what was observed. He believed science was about reduced to what was observed. This was called operationalism in those days, or it was called positivism more properly. It was a philosophical view that the world was constructed from our observations of it. And therefore, there couldn't be any absolute things behind the world because we couldn't observe them. We couldn't tell if the world was 10 meters to the right or not. And this was essential for his view of life, for his philosophy, and therefore, he developed them into physics. So you have different philosophical views. Now, how do we tell the difference? How do we tell which is right?
Okay, would we be able to tell if we should tell the universe 10 meters right? But if we shift time and hour ahead,
would
we be able to tell the difference?
No. How could we tell if it was just, you know, it's another question. Supposing the universe started 10 minutes earlier, but started exactly the same way. Could we tell the difference?
It started an hour off, but we're still in the same solar cycle.
No, the whole thing started. The Big Bang was 10 minutes earlier.
Like it starts an hour off, but the sun is still in the same place.
No, but the sun gets to where it is an hour earlier. Everything gets...
All that.
Then, yeah, so you can't tell. And therefore, Einstein was over here. Sorry, I don't know anything.
You could basically cut out all periods of time in which there's no change, and then knit it back together, and you still get the same answer.
Yes, and that's what Einstein proposed. But none of you is saying the important thing. Were you going to say something?
Since everything is relative, and it's all about the interaction between, say, particles, people, the environment, if everything started at the same point, then all the relativity would still be the same, because all the interactions would be identical.
Absolutely. So I'm with you there. I'm asking, but... Okay. And you're over here with Einstein. Okay. But now here it is. Okay, it's 1915. There's Newton's theory of space and time and gravity. Because gravity, Newton has a theory of gravity coming out of this. There's Einstein's theory of space and time and gravity. Gravity comes out of the difference. Okay. It's not. This is the point I'm trying to make. It's not just mathematics. It's not just problem solving and working out and doing your homework. Okay. There's deeply held views about philosophy and the nature of reality behind these things. Okay, how do we decide which to believe? Yeah?
It depends if we are religious people or not, as Newton Einstein was.
Okay, that's one answer. How else? Is there an alternative? Because if it's just one's religious views... What?
It's just in our mind when we, we have something.
Okay. No, but let me say, if your answer is the only answer, if your answer is a answer and it's a satisfactory answer for an individual, but if your answer is the only answer, then some people will believe this, and some people will believe this, and some people will believe in something else, and some people will believe in such a fourth thing. Okay? And that's not what science is. I'm not here to talk about religion and philosophy. I'm talking about science. I'm saying that behind people's ideas about science are ideas about philosophy and sometimes religion. Okay? But is science different from philosophy? Can we decide things in science that we can't in philosophy?
That's the results that we get from experiments.
Okay. That's what I've been looking for. So the difference between philosophy and science, and now I'm making a controversial claim. Some people would disagree with me. And somebody asked where I stand. Okay, so this is where I stand. Okay. This leads to some predictions about how the planets move, for example, about light and how light travels. This leads to some different predictions. And where science gets tough in the sense that you can be wrong, even if you passionately believe something, is that a good scientific theory makes predictions, and those predictions can be tested. So, for example, do I still have a blackboard here? Okay. If there's a star here, let me put a star here, and the sun is here, and we are here on Earth. Okay. Newton's theory predicts that light goes in straight lines. And therefore, sorry, I told you I don't draw well. Newton's theory predicts that light goes in straight lines. Therefore, if a star passes behind the sun, we can't see it. Einstein's theory, because the geometry of space depends on where the matter is, it turns out that Einstein's theory predicts that light is bent going around a star like the sun. Okay? That means that if during an eclipse, when the moon blocks the sunlight, that if you looked at the edge, near the edge of the sun, blocked by the moon so you can look at it, or if you had a camera and took a photograph, okay, then the star would seem to be shifted up here. Okay? Newton's theory says no. Einstein's theory says the star will be shifted and predicts exactly how much it would be shifted. Okay? The experiment was tried in 1914 and it was cloudy. Which is good because Einstein actually had the wrong prediction in 1914 because he didn't quite have all the pieces of his theory in place. The theory was tried again in 1919. Just after, you have to also remember there was a war between 1914 and 1918, the First World War, during which Germany and England were on different sides. Einstein was a German scientist in Berlin. The person who led the experiment was Eddington, who was a British astronomer. When all the plates were analyzed, they went, I forget where they went, somewhere in Africa or the South Pacific. Did anybody know? Africa. What?
South.
I think the South Pacific. Okay. Anyway, when they got done analyzing the plates, Einstein's prediction was right. Okay. Now, This is why we're going to teach you general relativity the rest of this week. What if you still believe philosophically over here? Okay, what do you do? Okay, because you might. Okay, I have friends who do. Okay, and the answer is that what you have to do is invent the next theory that goes beyond general relativity, okay, in such a way that it's over here. Okay, because the experiments are determinant. The experiments choose between the theories. The experiments don't really choose between the philosophies. Okay? The philosophies are behind things. They make people, they motivate people to do all the hard work and to do these things. At least that's not clear, that the relationship between the experiments and the philosophy is harder. For example, in the Soviet Union, the philosophy over here was judged to be anti-Marxist and anti-Leninist. And in the Soviet Union, there was a reinvention of general relativity in a way that faked being over here. That is, they rewrote general relativity in such a way as to pretend that there was an absolute space and an absolute time. And this is what was taught in the Soviet Union, okay, because it was believed to be compatible with Marxist-Leninism, whereas this was believed not to be compatible with Marxist-Leninism.
How do they argue that it's not compatible with Marxist?
I will let you do that, but Lenin, this was not low-level stuff. So I've skipped in the philosophy here. There was a philosopher and a physicist called Ernest Mach, okay, who maybe you learn about in general relativity. He worried about certain experiments and invented a certain way of worrying, which was the bridge between Leibniz and Einstein. Okay, and Lenin wrote a book against Mach. Lenin took the time to write a whole book against Mach, and because of that, general relativity could not be taught in the Soviet Union. Okay. But on the other hand, the experiments worked over here. Okay. So they had to reinvent this theory so that they faked it being over here. Okay. And there were people who did that. The Soviet Union produced great mathematicians and great physicists in their period, some of the best particle physicists, some of the greatest mathematicians of our period came from the Soviet Union, but those guys were really confused if you talked to them about general relativity. Okay, of course, growing up in the Soviet Union, they didn't believe, you know, anything about Marxism and Leninism and so forth. And they used to tease us that it was only stupid intellectuals in the West who still believed that. Anyway, I'm getting off my subject. The point is, when you come to the next theory, now I think I have just a few more minutes. So the next theory, let me come back to what I read from Einstein's book, because what I read from Einstein's autobiography, remember, was two things. One was that he didn't believe in quantum mechanics, because he didn't believe that God plays dice over there. And the second is that quantum physics, however it was formulated, had to be somehow joined with the theory of space and time. And that problem of joining quantum physics and space and time is called the problem of quantum gravity, which is a largely unsolved problem, although there are different approaches to it. And there's a lot of controversy between those approaches. So I think already you had Amanda Peete talk about string theory. Is that right? Amanda gave an introduction to string theory. And you're going to have a talk about spin foam models or something like that, from somebody's name.
Simone.
From Simone.
Okay,
at the end of the week. Okay, so there's our different approaches, and there's a controversy between them. And I'll tell you two interesting things about that controversy, and then I'll start to wind up. Okay. One of them is that if you really listen, if you really listen to what their people are saying in this controversy, okay, if you really listen and think, it's this controversy. It's the same one. If you really listen to what they care about and why some of them believe string theory, some of them believe loop quantum gravity or spin foam models, it really comes down to this same question about what is time and what is space. And the other thing is, why is there a controversy going on? Because this is science. And the answer is that there are so far no experimental tests. Okay, what resolved it here, and notice, by the way, the timing. Einstein wrote down general relativity in 1915, and by 1919, there was a crucial experimental test. So fast. It didn't wait. Okay. Just between the theory and the experiment was a few years. Okay. But at the present time, for better or worse, there have not been experimental tests. So the controversies remain. And this is good and bad. It's bad because science is not actually a good home for controversy. People don't know how to disagree in science. Because in science, you're always taught that there's a right answer. And if you work hard, you solve the problem, you do the laboratory thing right, you find out what the right answer is, and you get the right answer. So scientists are actually very poor controversialists. You don't know what to do when there's no right answer, because there are no experiments. But the good part is that there's something for you guys to do. Okay? That is to trace the history of this and bring it back to Einstein. Einstein, starting in 1905, started quantum mechanics. That is, he was the first person who understood that light consists of waves and particles, and that there was a problem with how light could be both a wave and a particle. He was the first person who understood that quantum mechanics had to give just statistical predictions. He was the first person who really understood that there was Max Planck, if you've heard of that, but Max Planck didn't really understand what he was doing. Einstein was the first person who really understood there had to be a radical break with the physics of the past to give you quantum mechanics. But still, quantum mechanics, for Einstein, made no sense. It was not complete. And nothing has changed. The things that Einstein was worried about, that he didn't believe about quantum mechanics, are still worries. And second, Einstein also invented general relativity, which is a theory of space and time and gravity and motion, different from Newtonian physics. The experiments support it. But so we're sitting here with quantum physics and we're sitting here with general relativity. Okay. Both of them are very successful experimentally, extremely successful experimentally. Okay. But they cover different parts of experiments. Quantum mechanics works in the laboratory. It works with elementary particles, atoms, molecules, materials, light, radiation, electronics. General relativity works at the level of planets, the solar system, galaxies, with this small little problem about dark matter, which you'll hear about next. But assuming the problem of dark matter can be fixed, general relativity works at the level of galaxies. And then cosmology, with the exception of another little problem called dark energy. But assuming that can be fixed, it works at the So we're in the middle of things. If we were really done, we would have answered Einstein's questions and unified general relativity and quantum mechanics, but we have not, and we would have made sense of quantum mechanics. So the key problems that Einstein left over are still unsolved, and so there's a great deal, and unless one of us here gets really lucky, okay, by 4 or 5 years from now, when you guys are ready to start doing research, the problems will be there as well. So that's the good news. Is that there will be the key, most important problems are not solved. Okay, so I'll stop there and take questions. We have a few minutes for questions.
Any questions?
Could you tell us about the loop theory? Because I don't think you'll have a talk.
You will. Simone is going to talk about a modern version of loop quantum gravity. Okay, and that's it. I'm at the end of my time. So loop quantum gravity is an approach to the problem of quantum gravity. I'll just say one thing. When you're all done with loop quantum gravity, and you draw pictures of what space-time looks like at the smallest scales, okay, you get these pictures with triangles like that. Okay, now isn't that weird? Somebody pointed that out to me at some point. But you get that space is made of little atoms, discrete parts that fit together like those triangles fit together. Okay. Yeah.
Could you ever perform an experiment to answer that question? If there's no change, like is there time? Like, would it be possible to create an experiment that would answer that question?
Well, what one can do is compare a theory where it's true and a theory where it's not true, and try to find an experiment that really focuses on that. So what's certainly true in general relativity, okay, is that the rate at which time flows depends on some things. In special relativity, it depends on the relative speed between the observer and the object. But in general relativity, it depends on the gravitational field. For example, clocks lower down in the gravitational field run slower than clocks further up. That means two things that are easily testable. An atom at the surface of the sun, so atoms have intrinsic rates of vibration, which can be detected in the frequencies of light they emit, which vibrate at those frequencies. Those are the spectra of atoms. Okay. According to general relativity, because the rate of time depends on the matter and depends on the gravitational field, an atom at the surface of the sun, which is in a deeper gravitational field than we are, emitting light towards us, if you compare that with light from the same atom, the frequency should be shifted downward, a certain precise amount which can be computed. Okay. And that experiment was done, I'm trying to remember when, 1920s, 1930s? It was done pretty quickly after the prediction, and that comes out. But not only that, if you go to the elevator shaft in this building, and you put an atomic clock, a very precise clock, at the bottom of the elevator shaft and at the top, and you synchronize them by sending photons back and forth, and this can be done in a four-story building like this, you discover that the clock at the bottom of the elevator shaft is running slower by a measurable amount. And can you do this experiment? I don't know if we're equipped to do this experiment here, but...
I wouldn't think so. I would guess you would need pretty accurate.
You need mass power spectroscopy, or at least you needed it when I was a graduate student and we did these in our lab. But you could do this. These days, this is, you don't need much more technology than, you know, goes into GPSs and cell phones and so forth. And in fact, having mentioned that, okay, the whole GPS system, you know, there are satellites where you're sending out signals, and because of that, your cell phone, if you have a sufficiently advanced, is this true? I think it's true. Anyway, there you can get cell phones which receive these signals and know where they are. This system has built into it, that is, the computations by which the cell phone figures out where it is, or the GPS thing in the car figures out where it is. They have built into them general relativity, the fact that the space and time, that space is curved because it's near the Earth, which is in a gravitational field. And this GPS system would not work were it not for general relativity. So there's a lot of detailed confirmation of this over that. Okay. Now, does that really prove that the vision or the conception of time in general relativity is right and the one in Newton's physics is wrong? I think that's a very interesting question. And there are people who debate that question now. There are people who write books about that question. There are professors of philosophy who write articles about that question and argue about that question. So it's a good question. Yeah?
Could you explain why this side of the question that no time does not change, I mean, there's no time, or past no time, there is no change, predicts that stars will bend light around them? How does that?
That's a very good question. You can get half the effect from the special theory of relativity. Okay, and maybe since you're going to do special relativity in the next few days. Not in the 3 minutes that I have. So let me put it this way. One of the mentors is doing that, and out of the mentors groups, do they still come presentations?
There will be a poster presentation. Yes.
Yeah. So I would suggest that as something. Okay. If you don't get that from this, then ask any of the people who are the teachers or the mentors to sit down. It would take 15 or 20 minutes to explain it. Once you have the basics of, well, except for Sundance, we'll do it right. It'll take him 25 minutes.
Yeah, I'm just talking about it. I'm not sure if we can necessarily address it as easily enough if there's no change. But
No.
You can do it in a couple of minutes, the question of if there's absolute time.
Then you get the wrong answer.
Yeah.
Anyway, if nothing satisfies you, I'll be around next week and you can ask me. But I think that it's a good challenge for the teachers and the mentors here. Yeah?
You said that you could maybe go back to how physics sort of question of why are we here?
Yes. I'll keep talking until you cut me off.
Did you want to join us for the afternoon tea? Potentially we could just the break.
Is that happening now?
Yeah, that's happening right now. So potentially we could just sort of break for that.
Sure. I'd be happy to. I can try to answer in a minute. Okay. Somebody wants me to sign something, but I can do that. So let me answer in 1 minute. Okay. The question of why the laws of physics are the way they are, okay, is a key question in physics. Absolutely a key question in physics. And let me just add something to spice this, and then I can discuss this in the tea. Okay. It turns out if you take the laws of physics as they are, and you take quantities in the laws of physics like the mass of the electron, the mass of the proton, the mass of the neutron, the strength of the electric charges of these particles, okay, and you change any of those numbers, okay, then there's no more life in the universe. There's no more stars. Change any of those numbers more than 20%. There's no more stars that burn. There's no more stable nuclei except hydrogen. Therefore, there's no carbon or oxygen. Therefore, there's no carbon chemistry. Therefore, there's no life. But as far as we know, the laws of physics would be completely consistent with those changes in the numbers. Okay, and that leads to a bunch of questions that we can discuss over tea.
Okay, let's play the tea.